Let the madness begin as the NCAA tournament tips off today. I'll break down all the brackets and share who will make it to Phoenix and represent in the Final Four. The baseball season is underway on another continent and there's already controversy surrounding Shohei Ohtani. Tragedy strikes the NHL not once, but twice this week. Some fringe signings and another retirement in the NFL. And anything that's happening in the association, I got you covered as we get into it here on the latest podcast. It's all coming up, but first, this message. I'm elated and honored to welcome in a new partnership here on the podcast. Are you familiar with Olipop Soda? If you're not, well, listen up. I haven't been a soda drinker for quite some time, but when I discovered Olipop and what they're all about, I was all in. Not only is it a prebiotic soda that's good for your gut, it's non-GMO, organic, with ingredients that you can actually read. That's right, no 12 or 14 letter words that you can't pronounce. And are you worried about the dreaded high fructose corn syrup? Not here, as there's very little sugar, 4 grams per serving. And then the flavors? You have vintage cola, orange squeeze, my favorite, tropical punch, banana cream, what? Plus the classics such as root beer, lemon lime, and ginger ale, which has a better taste. How could I forget? The taste. Crisp, refreshing, without feeling bloated afterward, than the usual brands that you're familiar with. Right now, you can get 15% off at checkout when you use the code SODALOVE, and I'll get a percentage of that based on your purchase. It's a win-win for both of us. Please go to drinkolipop.com and use SODALOVE for 15% off at checkout. Thanks to the good people at Olipop, and an early thank you for shopping at drinkolipop.com. J-Reels here to spend a brief moment and share a friendly reminder to please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on whichever platform you listen to on the regular, just so we can increase the visibility of the J-Reels podcast to those who aren't familiar with it. Leave plenty of stars, write a favorable review. It will go a long way for the curious listener looking to hop on board to get a dose of entertaining and passionate sports talk. For the visually inclined, please subscribe to my YouTube channel at J-Reels as I post daily shorts and weekly vlogs, not only delving into the world of sports, but follow me on my journey to take the podcast and channel to new heights as I provide an in-depth, behind-the-scenes look at what it takes for yours truly to produce content on a day-in, day-out, week-in, week-out basis. It goes without saying how much I truly appreciate all of your support. And without further ado, the J-Reels podcast begins in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's get this sports podcast party started, all right?
The J-Reels podcast.
Why don't you wait until July 1st to make an announcement? What a disgrace. He can rack up all these numbers in October, November, and December, but what really counts is let me see this in January.
The sports rebel without a pause, delivering fast-paced, jam-packed sports talk like no other.
Listen, I gotta call it as I see it. He is not a good player. I'm sick and tired of having to deal with the disappointment of this franchise. When does it stop? And yes, another winter that I can sleep in peace. Coming correct, directed, and in full effect. Let's get it.
This is the J-Reels Podcast. Welcome aboard.
What is happening, my good people? Greetings. How are you? How's it going? How's everybody doing out there? What is the latest and greatest? Hope everybody's doing well, feeling fantastic, in excellent spirits. The madness has arrived, and so has the rest of the sports world following suit, as I'll keep you abreast on everything that's happening in the world of sports, as this is the J-Reels Podcast with your host, J-Reels. For my first timers, welcome aboard, and for those who've been banging with me going back to the very beginning, somewhere in the middle, or even as early as this past Monday, I welcome you guys and gals back, and let's get right to it. The tournament, which will begin from the time of this recording, in about 17 minutes. And for those who are wondering, well, wait, J-Reels, how could you record this without relinquishing your Final Four? If you haven't already checked, and I understand by the time this is already posted and games already have been concluded, I did go to my YouTube channel, at J-Reels, to post my Final Four picks, as well as Instagram, TikTok, etc. So just for those who are wondering, as far as me trying to get a little bit of a leg up, and we understand there's only a couple of games that are going to start, the first one being Mississippi State and Michigan State. So it's not as if every game is being played at the time of this recording to where I could get a leg up onto what's happening in the tournament. So here we are right now, literally 17 minutes away, maybe less than that, for another tournament to tip off, and it's going to be wall-to-wall NCAA the next 2 days, pretty much from noon till about 1 a.m., and then into the weekend where we'll have 48 games from now until Sunday night, and then a Sweet 16, which we'll obviously recap on Monday's podcast. But as for right now, Yes, we could get into the first four games that had taken place where we had Virginia, who couldn't throw the ball in the ocean off of a boat. They were atrocious. I know a lot of people thought they didn't deserve to be part of the first four, and we could say that for the St. John's and the Providences of the world who didn't make it into the tournament by the selection committee. But Virginia, their offense was putrid. Their head coach, Tony Bennett, had no answers, and they said bye-bye as far as them trying to make any noise. And we know that this is not the Virginia team that won a national championship back in 2019. But for the Cavaliers to really go out meekly into the night, not score a point in the final 9 minutes of the first half, and not register a field goal in the second half at all over the last 10 minutes, 14 first half points, 42 points overall in the game. I mean, you can't get any bad than that, or even worse than that, I should say. And for them to just go off into the night quietly. And on the flip side of that is Grambling State, their first ever tournament win. They were down by double digits in the second half, and they came all the way back to not only tie, but then win it in overtime. And for Grambling, just a terrific job by them, to Grambling State, that is, for them to get into the tournament, to be a part of the Field of 64. And their daunting task right now is to go up against the number one seed and the Purdue Boilermakers. So I'm sure they are happy to be here. Who knows what the outcome will be come Friday. We would think Purdue, who has a lot to answer to in this tournament because of what happened last year, losing in the first round to Fairleigh Dickinson in the first game as a 116, and here they are in another 116 matchup. You would think that they will make amends and kind of be the Virginia of this tournament. Because remember, in 2018, Virginia lost for the first time ever as a one seed to the 16th seeded ranked, what was it, UMBC, Maryland of Baltimore County. And then the following year, they won the whole enchilada, as we talked about. And who knows, maybe this could be Purdue in order to rehabilitate and also get some payback for what happened last year to go ahead and maybe win the whole thing this year. But we'll uncover all that now as we get right into the tournament. And I'll start off in the East, because as we talked about on Monday, this was going to be a bracket for UConn that was going to be rigorous, because you had three other teams who won their conferences that are right below them at the 2, 3, and 4 seeds, whether you're Iowa State, whether you're Illinois, and then the 14 to round it out would be Auburn. And not only I think this is the toughest bracket, but I think this is the one bracket that you could actually get each of the top four seeds represent in the Sweet 16. And as we look at it, UConn, we know they're going to see if they could defend their title to be the first team since the 06-07 Florida Gators to repeat. We understand that that's a very daunting and even unenviable task, because a lot of other teams, not that there's been a dominant college team, we understand that the landscape of college basketball is a far cry from what it once was with the one and dones, and obviously in this day and age with the transfer portal, NILs, etc. But for UConn, we would think that their quest to repeat is not only going to be a tough one, but I would think if they were to be able to get to the Final Four, not to say it's going to be easy from that point on, but you would think that as long as they get to Phoenix, where the Final Four will be held, who knows? Maybe they'll sense it, they'll smell it, to know that history, despite the fact that there'll be a lot of pressure on them to repeat. But considering that they have a path that is going to be pretty tough for them, and it's going to be interesting to see how Iowa State, based on what they did to Houston in the conference tournament last week, same for Illinois and what they were able to do, Auburn as well, and how I look at this bracket, I can see those top four seeds moving on. As far as the rest of the bracket altogether, we get it that San Diego State made it to the championship game last year, but are they going to have another run in them? I don't know. I'm not going to look at teams like Yale and Duquesne, and just like I said on Monday, I get it that I'm parachuting into the tournament. So to really break down these brackets, whether it's the Oaklands of the world, whether it's the Yales, as I mentioned, or even the Samford, the Akrons, I'm not going to talk about their roster or really roll up my sleeves to unpack like, oh, this is a team to look out for. I'm going to be straight, honest, and transparent to go through each and every game, or even those teams that are at the bottom of each of those brackets. We'll be here for an hour and a half. And obviously, I want to kind of get you in and out, move on to other sports as well. But for the East, I just see it being those four teams. Is there another team that's in that bracket that can make some noise? Based on what I've gathered here over the last few days, it is possible that maybe UAB, but even then, who knows if they're going to be able to even get past this first round against San Diego State. I'm not going to say Yale or Duquesne. To me, there really isn't a sleeper in this bracket. I could see these top four moving on, as I mentioned. And if that's going to be the case to where they make it into the Sweet 16, that is going to be a fascinating bracket to look at as the scene will shift from Brooklyn to Boston, especially more so for UConn. But when we get to the Sweet 16 in that region, it's going to move from the borough of Kings up to Massachusetts there in Beantown. So that's how I'm looking at that bracket. And the team that I have coming out, and maybe I should save that for the end, a little suspense. So the East, not really much to dive into when we unwrap that. But when we get to the West, North Carolina, who had a big year behind Hubert Davis, especially after 2 years ago, Davis coming in, making it all the way to the title game after beating Duke in the Final Four. And after having a subpar year last year, bouncing back nicely this year with RJ Davis and Armando Bacot, two guys who know their way around this tournament. And for them to go up against the likes of other key teams in their bracket, or in their region, I should say, whether it's Baylor, we could also take a look at the possibility of even Michigan State, which they may even play in the next game, because as I mentioned, Mississippi State and Michigan State will tip off the tournament. And there is a possibility that if Tom Izzo does happen to survive this game, to go up against North Carolina would be intriguing, although this is far from a vintage Michigan State team. Although we have seen them make runs even when they're the underdog, so we get it. The tournament is certainly a toss-up, very unpredictable as we know. But I would think that even with North Carolina and some of the other teams in that region, it's their bracket to lose. Now, could there be some Spartan magic here, especially if they get past Mississippi State? Quite possibly. I'm not going to expect that, considering that they did not do well in conference play. They had a real bad record, especially against top teams. So I would think North Carolina should come out of that bracket and into the Sweet 16 rather nicely. A team to look out for in this region is Grand Canyon. They're a 12th seed, and we know historically a lot of those big upsets come from the 5-12 matchup. And Grand Canyon is a team that could score. They're going to go up against St. Mary's, who has their own magic in their own right based on the tournament of recent vintage. But for Grand Canyon and a team like that, can they get to a Sweet 16? Can they go further? With the tournament, you never know. Look what happened last year when you had not only Fairleigh Dickinson make it out of the Sweet 16. I believe they made it into the Sweet 16, I should say. They didn't make it out of the Sweet 16. They were able to survive the first weekend. Then, of course, we know how the Final Four ended up. You had from four seeds down, you didn't have a one seed or any of the one seeds or even the top three seeds be a part of the Final Four. You had UConn, you had San Diego State, you had Miami, who I believe was ranked ninth. And then you also had FAU. So is this a thing where Grand Canyon could get the glass slipper fit and maybe be that Cinderella team to get them pretty far? Quite possibly. And when we also take a look at even other teams in that region that have been high, that have had good years, whether it's Arizona, and even though historically Arizona has not been a good tournament team, other than 97 when they won the national championship that year, when they beat Kentucky, that's the Lute Olson with Miles Simon, Mike Bibby, even Jason Terry, that backcourt that they had to propel them to win a national title. But when I take a look at this particular bracket, there isn't another team that I could see here. Even Alabama, I understand that they've been very good this year and certainly formidable, but I don't know how good they're going to be as far as getting deep into the tournament. Same for Baylor. I understand that they are a national champion just, what, 2-3 years ago? But are they going to have enough what it takes to get to the Final Four? I would think they're going to get to a Sweet 16, and who knows? Maybe when it's all said and done, they'll play North Carolina in the regional final. But North Carolina, to me, I think it's for them to lose. And based on the year that they've had, I could see them riding high and maybe even getting to Phoenix. And I say maybe because I'm not tipping my hand just yet as far as who's coming out of that bracket. To me, the South is wide open. And Houston, they deserve to be a one seed despite them getting whacked by Iowa State there in the conference championship final. But they cannot score. As you see, they're a team that likes to play in the mud. They like to be physical, play defense. But scoring is not a premium for that team. They're the type of team that wants to play a rock fight, street fight type of matchup. They want to play more of a 55-51 game as opposed to trying to be a track meet and go up against a team that could score. And that's a scary thing because when you look at Houston and the teams that are in their region, Kentucky's a big team that could score. Duke, although not a vintage Duke team, but still their reputation. And I'm sure John Shire, they're going to want to go deep into this tournament. So they probably won't see them until later on. Obviously, it's not going to be until the latter part of this tournament. You would think the opening round or two, they would be safe. But I certainly cannot trust Houston to do anything big in this tournament, especially from an offensive standpoint, because if they're going to go up against a team that could score and they do not guard the perimeter and they're not matching up with their team and their assignments the way they have been throughout the course of the year, then they can get to a point where they'll be 5, 10, double digit, and then they're going to have to come from behind that type of deficit. That is not the way Houston is built. So when we take a look at the rest of that bracket, the sleeper here, I think, is going to be James Madison. I know that's a team that a lot of people have followed throughout the course of the year and has been real sneaky amongst the, maybe, I'm not going to say the non-college basketball fan, but for those who aren't familiar with James Madison, of course, based in Virginia, this is a team that certainly can light up the scoreboard. They're going to be a team that I'm sure they're going to do whatever they can, especially against Wisconsin in that first game. And again, that's another 5-12 matchup. But Wisconsin, we would think that maybe they'll survive that. But James Madison's another team that I would keep an eye out for. I know Texas Tech, they're sixth. They're another team that maybe could be one that could go deep into this region, maybe even get to an Elite Eight game. And Wisconsin is a team, or excuse me, Texas Tech is a team we'll certainly have to keep an eye on. I don't know about Florida, even Colorado for that matter, who won their playing game in part of the first four there against Boise State. Marquette, I understand they're a two seed, but Marquette, they're also up and down. I can see them also having a run too, but this bracket, I think, forget about Houston. I don't trust them in the least. This is going to come down to a handful of teams, and I guess you could say that for each region, but to me right now, this is the most intriguing one because I'm not sold on Houston. And it could be any one of those other seeds, maybe 2 through 6, that could get out of here and make it to Phoenix to be a part of the Final Four. And then the Midwest, as I talked about Monday, one of the big storylines, this is Purdue's shot to get to a Final Four, finally. Now, Purdue, they've had a lot of misfortune here over the last decade plus, and this even goes back to the 90s with Gene Keady and Glenn Robinson, the big dog. So Purdue, they have Grambling State, who, as we just talked about earlier, they won their playing game. But when I take a look at this region, it is far. And I understand you have teams that have reputations, whether it's Gonzaga, who made it to a final 3 years ago against Baylor, or Kansas, who won the title 2 years ago. Even Creighton, a team that was this close to making it to the Final Four last year based on that bad call against San Diego State in the regional. You do have teams that have reputations here. Tennessee, with Dalton Connect, a guy that could certainly carry the team on his back and take him to a Final Four. So there are teams of note. You want to say Texas, too. Historically, they've had good teams, but they have never been able to get over the hump, even that 03 year when they made it to the Final Four. That was the year that, of course, Carmelo won at Syracuse. But, and then Oregon also has an 11 seed, well off of a lot of people's radar, but historically, they have been a team that has been a staple in the tournament, has gone far in the tournament, but haven't been able to get over the hump. So you have a lot of teams there that are of note as far as people being familiar with teams navigating their way around the tournament. But Purdue, this is their time. They have to get to a Final Four here. Now, anything after that, you would think you don't come that far to get that far. You would want to at least win that semifinal game and then get to a championship game. I get it. It's a toss-up at that point. But still, for this school, for this university, and even for the maybe even that region for that matter, this is going to be a big test for Purdue based on what happened last year and the comparisons to Virginia, as I mentioned earlier, and Zach Edey, one of the top players in the country. This is his time to shine and for that team to get to that point behind their head coach Painter. So how I break it all down, I understand this isn't sexy. I understand that this isn't a situation where I'm breaking down each game, each region in that regard, because what are we, maybe 10, 12, even 14 minutes into this podcast, I could take this up till at least an hour before I even get into the other sports. But this is how I'm going to look at it when I take the 30,000 foot view of this tournament. Out of the East, I'm taking Iowa State. I know they can score, and I know it's going to be tough because UConn is there. But UConn, to repeat, I think they're going to get to a Sweet 16, but I think after that, it's going to be a crapshoot. And you can say that for all the teams and all the other brackets and regions, the favorites that you would think that are going to come out of there. We understand that it's all based on momentum, the unpredictability of this tournament. But for whatever the reason, I think UConn, they may be able to get out of this region. And I think they could get out of the region based on their pedigree and them being a national champion. But I like Iowa State to come out of the East to represent there in that region. And then, just like I mentioned, I understand I may have tipped my hand with North Carolina, but I like UNC to come out of here. I don't think there's a big threat in that region. I understand Baylor's the team. Arizona, I don't trust. And for the Tar Heels to, maybe there's a little bit of some mojo and moxie, knowing that 2 years ago they were that close from winning a national title. And I'm sure Hubert Davis is trying to hammer that home to say, hey guys, 2 years ago we were here. We have two of the guys that were part of that team. To know what it takes to get through a region, to get to a national championship game. So I'm picking UNC out of the West. In the Midwest, I'm going to look at a team, and I know I've tossed back and forth on this, and this is going to be difficult for me to say, but I can't stand them. No, not Duke, but Kentucky. I think Calipari, that team cannot defend, but they could outscore anybody, and especially in that particular region, I think they'll do well. And Calipari, it's time for Kentucky to maybe surprise some people. Not amongst the dyed-in-the-wool college basketball fan, but I think for Kentucky that they're usually a top seed, that they've had a lot of expectations over the years. Yes, they did win a title in 2012, but remember, they went into that semifinal game against Wisconsin undefeated, and they lost in the semifinal game. And for everything that's happened since, they have not been able to get back to that mountaintop. But I think they'll make it to a Final Four this year just based on their offense. They had that guard Shepherd that could score, Reed Shepherd, who's fantastic. And I really think that Kentucky will have it in them, especially after last year. I believe they got knocked out in the first round off the top of my head as a 2-15 matchup. So I think they will certainly be on the comeback trail to get to a Final Four. And I have them coming out of the South. And then the Midwest, if I mention the Midwest first, it's actually the South. And the Midwest, I can't say Purdue. I hope that they make it there. I really do. But I got Creighton coming out of here, and that's based on what happened last year. They were that close, and I'm sure that they've been sitting on that all year long. And now that they're a three seed, and not to say that it's going to be an easy bracket, it's interesting because they're going to have Tennessee that they may face somewhere down the road, especially when you get to a regional semi. And obviously Kansas, I guess you got to put them in there, despite the fact that they were awful down the stretch and were terrible in the conference, Big 12 conference, when they got smacked. And for Purdue, who knows? I get it that they're a coin flip, but I have Creighton coming out of here, and my Final Four is already entrenched there. My championship game, I'm going to have Kentucky go up against North Carolina, and then your winner is going to be UNC. I get it that it's a little bit of a chalk pick to have a one seed go all the way. I like to switch it up. I wish I could pick a team that is a lower seed and that's a team that maybe is going to not come out of nowhere, but would be a shock to some people. But that's how I have my Final Four, my championship game, and my national champion as we get set. And by the time you listen to us, it's already going to be well underway. But for my 2024 NCAA Men's Championship, that's what I have there for this coming tournament. As for the women's, I can't really get into that because I don't follow it. I'm not invested in the way that I am with the men's, and even that is not saying much considering everything that I mentioned not only on Monday's podcast but even here today. But the only thing I could say is that the world, I know, wants to see the regional final between LSU and Iowa. To me, I thought it would be great if LSU was in the other region just to have them clash in a Final Four, but regional final, you could see Caitlin Clark go up against Angel Reese and LSU. So that would be theater, to say the least. And then on the other side of the draw, you have South Carolina, which we would think would go back. And as great as they've been over the years, led by their head coach, Dawn Staley, I think that they would settle. I won't say settle, that's too strong. I think that they would just go bonkers. And the networks, I believe ESPN is carrying it, to where you would have a final of LSU and South Carolina. And remember, they had that brawl there couple of weeks ago at the end. It wasn't really a brawl. That's a little bit too strong, but you had many ejections. You had tempers flaring. And I think that the college basketball world would love to see that rematch, to see how that would play out. But I will be on top of it. I'll keep sure or keep in mind that the tournament there on that side is relevant, and I'm sure it's going to even be heightened as the games go on. Now, if any one of those three teams get knocked off beforehand, it's certainly going to put a damper on the whole tournament. But if the basketball gods do cooperate and they do shine to the point where we do get that regional final between LSU and Iowa, and then possibly have a final, whether it's Caitlin Clark or LSU, go up against South Carolina, I'm sure the worldwide leader in sports would do backflips, cartwheels, somersaults, no matter what, because I'm sure that's going to attract a great rating. And it was smart for them. I believe this was, a few years ago that they moved the tournament up a day, or the Final Four, I should say, because in the past, they usually played the Final Four Sunday, sandwiched between the semifinals of the men's game and the national championship. And then they would play the championship game on the women's side after the men's championship, which at that point, does anybody really care? So now that they moved it up to where it's Final Four Friday and championship game Sunday, which is sandwiched between the men's semifinal and the championship game, I think it could be a huge boon for the women's sport if it does happen to fall that way. And I got my fingers crossed, because I would love to see that. And I will be on top of that just to, over the course of the next 2 weeks, to get along and see where those chips will fall on the women's side. And just to stick with basketball overall, now the NBA is going to be lost here, because you're not going to get the TNT games on Thursday over the next couple of weeks based on the tournament. You will get the TNT game on Tuesday night, as well as the Wednesday ESPN game. But other than that, you're not going to get a lot of NBA and matchups of that magnitude as we get toward the last, 13, 14, 15 games of the season. Last night you had Bucks and Celtics, where the Celtics got off to a big lead before they hung on to win at home against Milwaukee. They already wrapped up the division. No big whoop there, as they are now, even in the conference, 11 games over the Bucks. So they can pretty much put their feet up and coast, although you don't want to do that if you're second-year coach Joe Mazzulla, as I talked about after the All-Star break, and how the pressure is just going to mount with this team once we get into the middle of next month. Maybe not in the first round, but certainly conference semifinal, conference final, and maybe even an NBA final, because this is their year to do it. Now, granted, we have to wait to see who's going to be on the other side out west. Will it be Denver to defend their title? And as we know that the Nuggets are already beating the Celtics twice this year, close games, but still. And anybody else out west, I'm sure that could challenge the Celtics, whether you're the Timberwolves, who played well against the Celtics this year, or even OKC, which may be a little bit green, because although Minnesota has some playoff experience, but OKC does not, even with their head coach, even with those players. So that would be a big question mark for me, despite the fact that Oklahoma City right now is the top seed out west by the slimmest of margins. But the NBA, like I said, it's going to be rather quiet. You're not going to have a Saturday showcase game this week. In fact, let me see what games of note here over the next few days. And I know that the Pelicans, who've been playing well here, they have a trip to New Orleans and Miami over the next couple of days. So for those who are following the Pelicans and what they've been doing out west. But besides that, tonight the Knicks are in Denver, for those who care, especially the Knicks, as they have won four in a row after kind of being in and out here. I know coming out of the break, they lost four in a row and they've been up and down, but they've had a very good year overall, even with all the injuries. I know Anunoby, who they brought in for Toronto, is back on the shelf for how long, who knows. But the rest of the weekend, you don't really have a lot here. You have the Sixers playing the Lakers in LA tomorrow night. Phoenix and San Antonio for the diehard NBA fan, Wembanyama against Durant. Yeah, you don't really have a ton of good games here over the course of the next few days. And Philadelphia obviously will be in LA over the weekend. They'll play the Clippers on Sunday. So that's what you have as far as the NBA. Oklahoma City at Milwaukee, that'd be an interesting test. And Golden State at Minnesota. So those are a few good games. That's also on Sunday. Those are some games that you could chew on if you're in the association. But besides that, it's relatively quiet. Let me turn my attention to what's happening on the ice as I lace up my skates there, and you had just terrible tragedies and of the worst possible kind you could absolutely have. Now, it doesn't matter, and I don't want to even go into the scope of what these two players, one who maybe a lot of people don't know of, but because of the association that he had or has, maybe even had for that matter, based on some of the things that I've read when it comes to his girlfriend, and that would be Aryna Sabalenka. But the one player who had Paris the other day, and from all reports, he took his own life down in Miami, it was the former Pittsburgh Penguin player, and I know he played a lot of games in the KHL. It was the one Konstantin Koltsov, say that four or five times. He played with the Penguins for 3 years, from 2002 to 2006, between the 2003 and the 2005-06 era, and played in a handful of games. Didn't really have a big impact in the NHL, but did play elsewhere, and was known to have been dating Aryna Sabalenka, the number two women's tennis player in the world. Now, based on some of the things that I've read on her end, even though she's not granting any interviews and currently in the Miami Open, which ironically, she's down there for the next tennis tournament. Obviously not a major, but a big one after coming off the heels of Indian Wells in California last week. But for Sabalenka, who recently had made a comment saying that, if you read between the lines, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but seemed like they were together, but maybe we were in a breakup stage, and I don't know if that had anything to do with Koltsov's demise. Hopefully that's not the case. But for Koltsov, 42 years of age, and based on the police report that there was no foul play involved, that the homicide department ruled it a suicide, just a terrible story, no matter how you cut it. Thoughts, prayers, condolences go out to the Koltsov family, to Sabalenka, the Penguins, the NHL, etc. And then the other big news, and this one even hits a little bit more closer to home, because this is a player that I followed in the sport going back to the early 90s, and he played roughly 15 years in the National Hockey League. One of the, probably if you could argue, maybe a top 10 tough guy of all time. Chris Simon, who was drafted by the Flyers, and perfectly so, for a guy who is, what, 6'4", big guy, had the long hair, long reach, was a very good hockey player. He just wasn't a guy that was out there who had 4 minutes of ice time a night. Actually had some big-time goal-scoring years, 29 goals for the Capitals 1 year. Even the 1 year with the Islanders, he scored 10 goals, had 27 points, and I believe 67 games. So he was a guy that obviously was more pronounced with the physicality and being a tough guy, but he was also could play the sport relatively well, had very good skill. And for Simon, like I mentioned, drafted by the Flyers, was traded in that huge Eric Lindros trade back in 91, 92. That brought Lindros to the Flyers, and then won a cup in Colorado after they left Quebec and transplanted to Colorado. Won a cup in 96, their first ever cup, and then bounced around, played on the Capitals, did represent the Caps in a Stanley Cup in 98 against the Red Wings, then bounced around, played for the Rangers, Calgary, the Islanders, Minnesota. And that was also reported that he took his own life at the age of 52. Now, there may be thoughts about CTE, because he was a tough guy, obviously took a lot of abuse. Not to say that it was warranted, but obviously with the style of play and how night in, night out, being a resident tough guy, the punishment that's going to take not only on its body, but also, of course, with his head. And who knows if CTE was involved here. Of course, that's going to be the first correlation when it comes to a guy like Simon, who did have that rugged physical play throughout the course of his career. And then later on, he did play in the KHL, which also has its moments there for tough guys and physical play. But for Simon to have that long career, a very good career, and literally probably one of the top 10, if you could even put it together, if you rank it. And I understand people could say tough as far as even a guy like Mark Messier. But when I say tough, I'm talking about a physical player who had skill, but also was just tough. I mean, was a guy that was physical, would go to war with his teammates. And that's not to say Messier wouldn't do that. But we know Messier was more of an impact player, more of a just a dominant force offensively, was a guy that could run right through you, but he wasn't a guy that was willingly going to drop his gloves. And not to say that Messier didn't have a tussle or two throughout the course of his career, but for Simon, guys like Bob Probert, guys like even Tony Twist, who had much lesser skill than the aforementioned two tough guys, but still, when you look at just that whole scope of the top tough guys throughout the course of NHL history, Simon may belong in that top 10. Now, I haven't drawn up a list. I could probably go through the top of my head some of those guys. Ben Wilson. You can even go back to John Ferguson. People may even throw in Gordie Howe because he was the guy that originated the ultimate hat trick, the goal, assist, and a fight in the game. But Howe wasn't known for his physical prowess in that regard. So there's so many guys in the league over time. Dave Brown. I mentioned Tony Twist. People could say Stu Grimson to a certain extent, maybe being in that top 10. Ty Domi, although very short in stature, but obviously a guy that certainly had an impact on the game based on his just physical play. But for Simon, just a terrible story. A lot of outpouring of love and support from teams, organizations, former teammates, Joe Sakic, the GM of the Avs, of course, drafted by Quebec and Hall of Famer in his own right. Had a lot of nice things to say about Chris Simon, as well as former teammates that had played with them over the years, whether it was in Washington, whether it was even with the Islanders, they had a nice little tribute for Simon as well. But a terrible story, 52 years of age, way too young, and that's on top of Koltsov, who was 42 years of age when he took his life. And that was pretty much, when you think about it, sadly, a matter of hours, because when Koltsov's story came out, I believe it was early Monday, and it may have been somewhere even later that evening, because a lot of the reports early Tuesday when Simon had taken his own life, that a lot of it was erroneous. There weren't any confirmed reports of his death at that time. But I don't even know what else to say. Just two awful stories. Thoughts, prayers, condolences go out to the Simon family, the NHL. Man, I tell you, I mean, that's not the way to start off a hockey segment. I wish we could have kept it more to what's happening on the ice. But to have that, oh man, that is just two big gut punches there. And you got to wonder about Simon, whether or not there's CTE involved. Who knows if their family's going to maybe even possibly donate his brain to see what kind of effect that CTE had on him. We know that when Bob Probert had passed away, and I believe his brain was donated for CTE, and there was a lot of CTE that he had toward the latter part of his life, even though he died of a heart attack. But with Probert and his long history, not only of just alcohol abuse, even drug abuse, but of course, just living that fast life on and off the ice, and especially with all the fisticuffs and all of the bouts that he had throughout the course of his 17-year career, it was known that later on that he did have CTE. And let's see what's going to happen in Simon's case, whether or not his brain will be donated for that cause. So just two tough stories there. And as far as what's happening on the ice, last night you had an interesting game there between the Maple Leafs and the Capitals, to where you had Austin Matthews score a couple of goals. He now has 56 goals, went through a little bit of a drought over the last couple of weeks, and he's still on pace to reach 70 goals, which hasn't happened in forever. I believe from what I read, 3 decades, so that has to go back to Brett Hull, maybe even Mario Lemieux for that matter. Off the top of my head, I think it's those two guys. I know, of course, the guys before that, where their name is Wayne Gretzky, of course, Phil Esposito, Bernie Nichols, remember him? One time L.A. King even played for the Rangers, bounced around there, Devils. He scored 70 goals 1 year, I believe in that first year when Gretzky was traded from Edmonton to L.A. So to think he's a guy that could actually reach that plateau and has it within distance, who knows if he's going to be gunning for it, considering the Maple Leafs right now, they're in a stretch where they are trying to keep themselves in good stead there in the Atlantic Division. But as far as Ovechkin goes, because in that same game, he scored 2 goals in his own right, and now he is just 50 goals from passing Wayne Gretzky as the all-time leader in NHL history as far as goals scored. He is currently at 845, 50 to go, and he's actually had a little bit of a renaissance here after a long stretch where I believe over the course of like 40 games, he only scored 8 goals, but he's had a stretch where he's scored about 12 goals over the last 20-some-odd. So you have to see whether or not Ovechkin could even inch closer over the last 14, 15 games of the season. And if he were to go into next year, I would think with at least a shot, if he could be less than 40, because I don't know if he still has 40 goals in him. And that's age, was he 37 years of age? His body, I'm sure, is wearing down, although the guy's been a specimen his whole career. He's rarely missed games because of injury, and Ovechkin, I would think, for him to reach that a milestone next year, he would have to get to a point to where he would have to be, I believe, less than 40 goals going into next year. And that's my dog barking in the background, so my apologies for that. So for you have a situation where Ovechkin, and I know that the Capitals, they're trying to fight for a playoff spot at this present moment. Let me take a look at the standings here. The Capitals, as of right this second, even with the game last night, after that loss, they are 1 point behind the Red Wings for the final spot, where the Islanders there have drifted big time in the midst of a five-game losing streak. And the Capitals, who knows? Maybe they're going to try to make this push. Maybe Ovechkin is going to add another gear or kick it up here, even at 37 years of age, to see if they can try to get into the dance and maybe make some noise, even though they may not be long for the postseason. But for Ovechkin just being 50 away, that is just unbelievable to think that one record, which I would think that a lot of people thought would never be broken, would be Gretzky's all-time goal-scoring record, and it still may not. But I think Ovechkin will have to get to 856, we'll say 854, where he could tie that next year. But I think if he's less than 40 away, he would have a decent shot to get it next year. That's my prediction. And obviously, we don't know about injuries, etc., so we'll have to wait and see on that. But the rest of the picture here in the NHL, you have the Bruins still at top at 97 points in the Atlantic Division and tops in the league for that matter. And the Panthers are just 3 points behind them for first place. Big matchup there on Saturday night where the Panthers will play the Rangers at the Garden. There's your Saturday night showcase. It's actually in the NHL, not in the NBA. So the Panthers, who beat the Rangers a couple of weeks ago at the Garden, they come back to Metropolis to see whether or not they could come out of MSG with a victory and even separate themselves from the Rangers, who are currently tied with the Panthers in the conference at 94 points. So that's a game to look forward to. I know the Panthers have played well here. Excuse me, not the Panthers. The Hurricanes. I saw Carolina, so I'm thinking of the football team, not the hockey team. They beat the Islanders the other day here at UBS, and they've won four in a row. So they're sneaking up on the Rangers. They're just 2 points behind them for first place in the Metropolitan, which would mean a two seed overall. So let's see how the Hurricanes will play this out, especially with their additions there at the, All-Star break, actually at the trade deadline. I don't even know how they fared ever since they made those trades. I'll have to take a look at that more so come Monday. But the Lightning, who are currently first place in the wild card, 4 points ahead of the Red Wings for the two wild card seeds in the East. And we mentioned Boston, Florida, and Toronto. Those are your top three in the Atlantic, New York, Carolina, Philadelphia in the Metropolitan. As far as the Central, we've talked about this ad infinitum, where Winnipeg, Colorado, and Dallas, flat-footed tie, despite the fact that the Avalanche have won seven in a row. Nathan MacKinnon, hot as a pistol. I believe he has a 16-game point-scoring streak. Possibly could be your MVP. I know I've talked about various MVPs this year, whether your name is Nikita Kucherov. Obviously, MacKinnon, I'm sure you're going to have some votes there for one Connor McDavid, who is your defending two-time MVP. But between Winnipeg, Colorado, and Dallas, and Winnipeg is actually in the tri-state area, they beat the Rangers on Tuesday night. They had the Devils tonight, and they play the Islanders not necessarily on the island, but on Elmont, right there on the border between Queens and Nassau. I guess you could say it's the island, of course, considering that they are separated from the five boroughs. But with that being said, the Jets, let's see if they can continue their winning ways. They're in the middle of a three-game winning streak. Colorado, as I mentioned, seven in a row. Dallas has won two straight, all tied there with 93 points. Out in the Pacific, Vancouver still has a decent lead, 8 points over Edmonton, 94-86. Of course, Vancouver has the top spot in the West right now with all three of the teams in the Central vying for that top spot. And then the Kings are 3 points behind Edmonton in the division, where you have Nashville and Vegas. Nashville, 84 points in the first wild card spot, and then Vegas with the second wild card spot at 79 points. And then you have Minnesota at 76, St. Louis, 75, and you want to throw in Calgary, 71. I'll leave it at that, as they're 8 points behind Vegas and the Golden Knights, 69 games. A lot of those teams have played 69 games. Minnesota's played 70, so those other teams have a game in hand, whether your name is Vegas, St. Louis, Calgary, etc. And that's pretty much your NHL here in a big nutshell. As we move it along with baseball, that's right, the season has begun in Korea. As I lace up my cleats, getting a batter's box here, you've already had two games, and sadly, after the first game, there's already controversy with Shohei Ohtani. Now, no, not necessarily with him per se, but for Ohtani having a connection with his interpreter, that he had come over from Anaheim with the Angels and obviously be employed by the Dodgers. And a report came out that the Dodgers had to fire the interpreter. His name is Ippel Muzahara. I hope I pronounced that correctly. So I'll just call him Muzahara or Mizuhara. Mizuhara is a guy that has shadowed Ohtani here throughout the course of his career, or at least over the last couple of years. And there's been a report to where there's been a series of debts that Mizuhara has had to pay, and that Ohtani has actually had to bail him out, transferring money from his account to Mizuhara's account in order for him to pay off a significant amount. And we're talking about $4.5 million. Now, there's been accusations that this money's been stolen from Ohtani's account, because based on some statements that Mizuhara had said, going back to Tuesday when he was pressed by the, I guess whether it's the local press there or even LA and the Southern California media beat, they had come out to ask, what's this story that's come about here regarding he and these gambling debts and Ohtani? And let me see if I can pull some quotes here. Mizuhara, longtime friend, interpreter, $4.5 million in bets made through DraftKings. Mizuhara on Tuesday said that Ohtani wasn't happy about it, but that he would help him out to make sure that he didn't do this again. But then he also said yesterday that Ohtani was not involved, or I'm sorry, on Tuesday he did say Ohtani wasn't involved in this whole gambling debt or gambling situation, but then yesterday had came out and said that Ohtani had no knowledge of any of the gambling debts that he had, and that he didn't even help him cover those debts by transferring money to his account. So which one is it? Was Ohtani broached about what was going on here to the point where it's like, hey, I'm up to my eyeballs in debt. I need some help here. Can you throw me a few shekels or more than that to get me out of this? And although Ohtani obliged from based on what he said, but he also vowed to say, hey, come clean and let's not go there again. But then he came out to say that, oh no, he wasn't involved in a gambling, which of course that's separate. But then on top of that, Shohei had no knowledge of me gambling, and also at the same time did not transfer any money. So which one is it? And who knows if this story is continuing to unfold, and I don't think Ohtani is even involved. Maybe he knew about the gambling, maybe after the fact. Now, I don't know. He says it's a longtime friend. I don't know how close they are. I don't know if it's a situation where Mizuhara is gambling behind his back, or let's say they're out having dinner and he has to get on the app to make a gamble on a wager regarding, a lot of it he said was basketball, NFL, etc. But did Ohtani have any knowledge of this? Now, I don't think Ohtani went as far as even making any type of wagers on that, because obviously that'd be a no-no, and he would probably, I don't know what the rules are for suspension when it comes to baseball players, but certainly not a good optic considering the association. Of course, Mizuhara is out. Ohtani, I'm sure he's going to have to answer these questions at some point, especially when he gets back to the States, as I'm sure they're flying back now after they finish their two-game set in Korea, and I'll get to that in a second. But now, this is going to be a distraction, at least from the outset, as the teams land in Southern California, and this is something that Ohtani and company, they're going to have to address right now. And they would only hope that nobody's going to have a witch hunt out for Ohtani, that he does come clean, that he does say the truth, and he should take as long as he wants. Now, we know that Ohtani is a guy that's going to be close to the vest, private, etc. I'm sure the Dodger PR people are already in his ear. But if you really want this thing to go away, you have to sit in front of the media, give them at least a good solid 20 minutes, answer everything, and then it'll go away. Don't just write out a statement or come to the press and have it translated to you by another interpreter to say that I had no business knowing what was going on, I had no clue, I did not transfer money, so on and so forth, which is probably, that's what's going to happen. But I think it's better for him to be in more of a forum scenario to where he could just have all the questions thrown at him at once, and then he can move on. Because even in a statement, you know there's going to be somebody out there that's going to try to dig up some dirt on Ohtani, and then he's going to have to revisit this thing all over again. And that's my point for him meeting the press now. Give them the good 20, 25 minutes. Answer everything off the bat. You want to come out with a statement to open? No problem. But anything after that, field everything. And they're going to ask you the same question 10,000 different ways. But guess what? Just answer it. And then, in all seriousness, it'll be gone. Forever, kaput, that's it. So don't read a few sentences and then go off into the night. Don't take two questions and then, oh, it's all over and done with. And by any means necessary, don't ignore this thing. Don't say no comment. Oh, we moved on. Oh, he's not on the team anymore. Because again, somebody is going to have it out for Ohtani to dig up whatever it is, whether it's through Mizuhara or somebody else or one of Mizuhara's associates who maybe knows Ohtani through him. You just never know. So that's what I have to say about that. As far as the games go, they split the two games. So the Dodgers are not going to go 162-0. They certainly have all the pressure on them, as we know. And they did win the game yesterday, 5-2, thanks to Jake Cronenworth, how his webbing of the glove, the ball went right through, which opened the floodgates for an eighth inning where the Dodgers scored four runs. Ohtani had two hits and an RBI in his Dodger debut. And then this morning, you had a game where Yoshinobu Yamamoto, in his first ever start, now mind you, let's see if he has a better start on American soil than he did out in Korea, because he didn't even make it into the second inning. Five runs in the first. I didn't watch. He threw, what, 43 or 45 pitches? Whatever command, didn't have it. He only walked one batter, but he did give up a ton of hits, and certainly not a debut that the Dodger fan or even Yamamoto was hoping for. But let's see what's going to happen stateside when he gets his first start at some point here in the first week of the baseball season, which begins a week from today. So I'll talk more about the baseball season next week. Obviously, I have a baseball preview, etc., which I'm certainly looking forward to unfolding and sharing with all you guys and gals out there. But besides that, that's what I have with baseball. I know you got some injuries here and there with the Yankees, DJ LeMahieu. I know Aaron Judge is on the way back. So that's going to be a big focal point for this Yankees team early on, to have those big guys in the lineup. We know Gerrit Cole's not going to throw a baseball for another 3 weeks or so. And I don't know if they're going to bring in any reinforcements, considering that he may come back, I would think, at the earliest, middle of May, maybe even Memorial Day for that matter. So baseball will follow suit next week, as we'll certainly get into it. I'll roll up my sleeves and for sure talk about a 2024 MLB preview. And then lastly, let me put on my helmet and shoulder pads. Just a couple of football news and notes. Nothing really big to unpack here. The Jets made a big signing, bringing in Mike Williams, the longtime LA Charger receiver. 1 year, I believe it was, what, $14 million? Or maybe $12.5 million, whatever it is. So to complement Garrett Wilson, excuse me, and we'll see what they do in the draft, whether or not they draft the tight end Brock Bowers. They already brought in a couple of tackles there with Tyron Smith from the Cowboys. They also brought in John Simpson, the guard from the Ravens, as well as Morgan Moses, the other tackle. So as they try to put this line together for Aaron Rodgers to stay upright, they're trying to bring in some weapons, and Williams does bring him that guy, or brings Rodgers that guy, that could certainly be a big-time target for Rodgers next year. So we'll see how that plays out. Chase Young, boy, how big that star has fallen. The former number two pick overall in the draft via the Washington football team at the time gets traded to San Francisco, had a little bit of an impact, had a sack in the Super Bowl, but signed a one-year $13 million deal with the Saints. So this is pretty much going to be a big year for him upcoming, whether or not he could get that big payday as a pass rusher, which are at a premium in the sport. So Young, as he tries to resurrect his career coming off an ACL a couple of years ago. So you have that there in the Big Easy. And then another retirement with Leighton Vander Esch, the former Cowboy linebacker who suffered that neck injury even a couple years back, came back, played a handful of games this year, said his body won't cooperate, played 6 years in the league, actually was a very good, solid, impactful linebacker, tackling machine. But like you mentioned, the body won't cooperate. So therefore, he had to hang up his cleats and his helmet and shoulder pads and say goodbye to the Cowboys and the NFL. So that's sad in that regard. But obviously, with a lot of these players retiring early, we saw Aaron Donald last week. Now, granted, obviously a bigger body of work going into the Hall of Fame, Super Bowl champ, etc. But still, 32 years of age, and he still left money on the table. He still wanted to have his wit and his body intact. And you have to answer to your body. And this day and age, I understand. If this was 30, 40 years ago when linebackers were making maybe just a couple million dollars, and they needed that guaranteed money, and they needed whatever they could, because the sport was a different world back then. And not only that, but pride and a lot of that factored into continuing to play until the wheels fell off. But for players of today's game, they know that, wait a minute, if I have an opportunity to get out, even Luke Kuechly is another guy off the top of my head who retired, I believe, at 29, that when they know it's time, they just go. Because as brutal as the sport is to train almost year-round and to go through the rigors of training camp in the middle of summer, obviously a long season, if you're lucky enough to get into the playoffs, to get to a Super Bowl, and then to ratchet it up and do it all over again year after year after year, taking a toll is an understatement. And I'm not just talking about the body, but also the mind, the spirit, and the soul. So for Leighton Van Der Esch, kudos to you, my guy. And best of luck on your next chapter in life. And then one last thing before I bid adieu. I didn't mention this the other day, but I know the 9 conferences in college football, just to continue with the gridiron theme, we talked about this weeks ago when the 2024 playoff was going to be approved, the 12 playoff teams, and we've been through that and how that's going to shape up from December 20th pretty much to the January 20th, the whole month of college football playoff games starting this coming fall and into the winter. So now, before you can even get to the 12-team playoff, it's already been confirmed that the 9 conferences, including Notre Dame, have approved a 14-team playoff for 2026. How do we know if the first 12 are going to work if we haven't even got the 14? Obviously, you think it's going to work when it's all said and done. I get it. But I just find it so weird that we haven't even gotten to the first part of the college football playoff to where we can really get a sense, a feel, etc., as to how this is going to... Now, it's going to wreck the regular season, as we know, because you're not going to have the thrill of who are the committee going to select. Yes, more so at the bottom rung of who's going to get the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th seed, maybe. But as far as that top four, as we saw throughout this past year, with Florida State getting snubbed, etc., and we've been through that before. But it's going to be different this year, not having that same type of, I don't want to say drama, but that intrigue as to, oh, who's going to pick... Which part of the selection committee is going to choose this team to get to the postseason? Yeah, you're going to have that next year and the year beyond, but it's not going to have the same feel, 4 teams, now that you're going to have 12. But in the scenario where now you're going to have 14, might as well have it 16, 18, and let it be a NCAA March Madness. In this case, it'll be December, January Madness. So, But again, we all know what it boils down to, people. Before they could even get to the 12-team playoff, they went to 14. It is about one thing and one thing only. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can see where I'm going. I'm rubbing the fingers there, if you can hear it on the mic. It's all about the cash, the money, the moolah, the green, the bread, the cheddar. That's what it's about. And if you didn't see, college football and ESPN, I believe up until 2031 or 32, I got to double check, they re-upped their contract. $7.8 billion. So you mean to tell me that by them expanding and ESPN re-upping on this deal for college football, and as I'm still recording this, let me see if I can pull that up real quick. They know that college football is very popular in this country, and there's a lot of people who follow it. And now that you're going to have a scenario where you're going to expand to 14 teams and know that you're going to have more teams in the mix when it comes to a playoff... And to have these games broadcasted, here it is right here. College football playoff, ESPN agree through 2031-32. 6 years, $7.8 billion contract. And why do you think they expanded to 14 teams starting in 2026? One more time. All about the cream. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all. That'll do it, my good people. Another episode just about in the books. Thank you so much for stopping by. Thank you so much for carving out precious moments out of your day to listen to what it is I have to say about what goes on in the world of sports. If you haven't done so, please subscribe, rate, and review. As I mentioned at the top, throw me a few stars. Come on, people. I'm a full-time content creator. I need all the reviews, the positivity, the good vibes I could get as I continue to march along here to put forth not one, but 2 podcasts each week, 8 a month, depending on the month. Sometimes it can be 9, 10, who knows? But I got you covered here with what goes on in the world of sports. Also, check in on my YouTube channel, at JReels. I put up a new vlog a couple of days ago. Fast forwarding time here. A couple of days ago. Definitely want to check that out. My 1 month out of leaving the 9-to-5 and doing what I'm doing now, full-time content creator. So definitely peep that. Also, subscribe, like, comment, share it with your friends, family, frenemies, foes, etc. Hit me up with a question, comment, suggestion on any of the following at YouTube or on YouTube at JReels, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, the JReels Podcast, Twitter, X, JReels1, just the number, or the old-fashioned way, the JReels Podcast at gmail.com. One more time, I'll be more than happy to follow up with you guys and gals, because whether you do or do not know, this is what I love to do, people. It's in the blood, it's in the DNA, as I like to say. Nothing but fire, passion, energy, fury. Who else is going to talk about all these different sports in 1 hour? I'm waiting, still waiting. I still haven't heard. Nobody. This is my niche. This is my wheelhouse. This is what it's all about. With my thoughts, opinions, critique, analysis, praise, feelings on anything and everything. That happens on the world of the diamond, ice, gridiron, hardwood, golf course, racetrack, tennis court, boxing ring, octagon, you name it. From my lips to your ears, from my heart to your soul, from where I am to wherever you are, the JReels Podcast always comes correct, direct, and in full effect. From the South Bronx, the South Beach, the South Central, the South Pacific, and all points beyond, peace, love, and God bless everybody. And until next time on the JReels Podcast, on the flip, baby.